You are listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. A volunteer-based photo-sharing project that helps the state monitor wildlife just hit a milestone. We'll tell you about how it works and how you can get involved coming up. Now, throughout history, from ancient times to the present, disasters have changed human life and experiences. And you may be surprised that it's not always bad. Sometimes destruction and tragedy teach us important lessons. We can see some of those lessons in the designs of cities and in other infrastructure that we take for granted. Our guest looked at past examples, hoping we can find some insight and invest in positive changes after the COVID-19 pandemic. You can join this conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think we've learned about different ways to live and organize our communities because of COVID? Are there specific changes you'd like your community to make in the coming months and years? Call 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Derek Thompson is a staff writer for The Atlantic. He wrote a piece called Get Ready for the Great Urban Comeback. Visionary responses to catastrophes have changed city life for the better. Derek, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
You give quite a few examples of disasters that have hit cities and then how they've used those to improve life going forward. So let's start with public health. That's the crisis we're currently living in. 19th century England was hit by one health disaster after another. Give us a sense of what people then were dealing with.
Yeah, so I think that we sometimes look back at the Industrial Revolution and we think, oh my God, that was the dawn of progress. It was the beginning of the kind of productivity growth that has yielded practically the entire modern world. But what it actually felt like to live in that hinge moment of history was pure pestilence. There was just constant epidemics, overflowing, overlapping, never-ending waves rushing into each other of influenza and typhoid and typhus, tuberculosis, cholera. I mean, it just never stopped. These cities were absolute horror shows. In fact, in the 1830s, in communities of 100,000 or more in England, life expectancy at birth fell to as low as 26 years old. And things got so bad that at one point, the government dispatched a young official named Edwin Chadwick. And Edwin Chadwick was a utilitarian. He was a dreamer. He had all sorts of interesting ideas for the future of mankind. And he undertook essentially this ethnography of urban England. He looked at how people lived and where their waste went and how cities were designed. And he said, you know, we've thought for decades, maybe centuries, that disease was a result of human failure. But when you actually study human life, you see that disease is a piece of architecture. It is something that we're not responsible for. It is socially created, and we need to socially create healthier cities so that people can live longer. And if you're a cold hard capitalist, produce more for your government and for your economy. And so he published this report, and this report in the 1830s really changed the entire face of progressive government. It invented the English public health department. It changed the way that countries across Western Europe thought about public health. And in many ways, public health historians told me when I talked to them about the legacy of Edwin Chadwick, they said just about every element of 21st century government that you consider progressive, from Medicare to Social Security, was in some way born from the Big Bang event of Chadwick's report. It was the beginning of a whole ethos of progressive thinking in the West. And it came from, as you said, these public health crises.
And it sounds like Chadwick paid attention to what was actually happening. He wasn't making assumptions, from some ivory tower. I mean, he was interviewing and talking to people who did the work every day, the people in factories. You also mentioned that they interviewed people like police officers trying to figure out what was actually happening in cities so that they could figure out how to improve it.
That's exactly right. And, the findings in this report just completely stunned the British government and really stunned people across Europe who read it. I mean, just one statistic from it, because there are so many that I could pick from. Chadwick calculated that the number of people who died of poverty and disease in British cities in any given year of the 1830s, in any one year of that awful decade, was greater than the annual death total of every military conflict in the empire's history. So as terrible as you knew war had been for the British, for the Spanish, for every global civilization at that point, poverty and disease because of the Industrial Revolution was worse. And it's because of this report and the way that the British government cleaned up its cities that people could actually enjoy the fruits of the Industrial Revolution, that it could make the world a better place to live. And that's why I think you can see this report of Edwin Chadwick as being akin to a big bang of progressive thinking, because from that moment really sprung forth modern liberal thinking about health and the working class.
Derek Thompson is a staff writer at The Atlantic, and he wrote a piece about how past disasters like floods and fires and disease changed the way that people built their communities. You can join this conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you wonder about how different communities have responded to major disasters? What might make living through this COVID-19 pandemic a little easier or more difficult based on how your community is built? You can share your story with us at 800-642-1234. Derek, let's stay in the 1830s, but let's move to New York City. You open your article with some terrible events that happened on a very cold night there in 1835. What happened?
Yeah. Yes, 1835, December 16th. By some reports, the temperature was 10 to 30 degrees below zero. And there was a terrible fire in Lower Manhattan that absolutely destroyed the city. And the reason the fire was so terrible is that when the firefighters came to pull water out of the wells and cisterns, there was no free-flowing water there. The rivers had completely frozen solid. And so what the city of Manhattan, what the city of New York realized is that they needed to do two things. They needed to find a way to get free-flowing water down to Lower Manhattan, even on cold days. And in addition, because they were also dealing with the cholera epidemic, they needed clean drinking water to be brought to residents. So what they did is they went upstate and they bought several acres of land near the Croton River in Westchester County. And they built a dam on that river and created a lake. And then they built a series of underground tunnels to carry that fresh water to every corner of New York City. This was an engineering triumph known as the Croton Aqueduct. It opened in 1842, and it completely changed the city. It gave New York its famous drinking water. It allowed the city's population to quadruple over the next four decades to more than 1 million people. And it really marked the beginning of New York becoming a fully modern metropolis. So sort of scoping out from this a bit, I think the lesson for cities in America today and really around the world dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic is that, New York didn't respond to the problem of the fire by just hiring more firefighters. They said, we need to deal with this crisis in a more systemic way. So they built a 40-mile aqueduct to bring water down into the city. I would like to see urban leaders, national leaders, rural leaders, leaders across the board, think about the problems America is facing in a more systemic way. This is not a crisis created just because we didn't close the border in time. It's not a crisis that's created just because, one disease got out of China or whatever it originated. This is a crisis that is systemic, created by insufficient insurance, insufficient aid to our frontline healthcare workers, insufficient planning for pandemics. And it deserves a systemic response and systemic reform going forward so that we don't have a respiratory crisis every decade this century.
Well, to bring it back to Manhattan in the 1830s, I mean, you say that at least some of the needs of that community were already known, and then it took this disaster of such magnitude to bring about change. It's hard not to see the parallels to now.
Right. Yeah, it's very hard not to see the parallels. And that's one of the reasons why I wrote the piece is that, I was initially just really struck by how some people were thinking really broadly and creatively and systemically about how to address the problems of COVID-19. While, I thought a lot of other leaders were being very narrow-minded and they were just reacting to whatever the news was that previous day. The news would get better and they'd open the bars. The news would get worse, they'd close the bars. They were so narrow-minded and so limited in their focus. And I would prefer that we all see this as an opportunity to change the way that we think about health, public health, individual health, and the design of our cities to make people healthier. And that is the charge that we take from this pandemic.
We're talking with Derek Thompson. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic, and we're talking about a recent piece that he wrote that discusses some visionary responses to different disasters that have changed cities for the better over hundreds of years. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What have you seen change in your community or in the country as a reaction to COVID-19? Have you seen improvements to infrastructure or how we live that you hope will stay in place? If you haven't, what would you like to see change? 800-642-1234. There's a line for you there, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. We continue this conversation here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're talking with Derek Thompson. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic, and we're discussing his recent piece called Get Ready for the Great Urban Comeback, Visionary Responses to Catastrophes That Have Changed City Life for the Better. And we're talking about what we can learn from centuries-old responses to terrible things that have happened in cities. And we're just discussing what we can learn right now. So, Derek, you were mentioning the COVID-19 crisis and writing it because you saw the parallels. Is there a concrete positive change that you have learned about or kind of been inspired by that you'd like to see come out of this?
Oh, yeah. I live in Washington, D.C. now. I was born in the Washington, D.C. area, and I lived in New York for 7 years in my 20s and early 30s. And one thing that always struck me about New York is that it seemed like a city that should be owned by pedestrians. And instead, in so many places, it was a city dominated by cars. And that seems to be changing. It seems to me that lots of cities across the country throughout the summer and into the autumn gave their street space back to the people, and they took it from the cars. In the last 50, 70 years, our cities, I think, have been over-designed to be accommodating to cars. And this isn't good for cities in several ways. It takes a lot of space, a lot of valuable space away from the public. And it also exposes people to, you know, a lot of long-term exposure to pollution from cars and trucks that are snaking through the city, which cause thousands of premature deaths in the U.S., along with respiratory conditions that are aggravated by the pollution that comes from cars. So I would love to see cities continue that trend into 2021, when hopefully we have everybody vaccinated from COVID-19. I would absolutely love to see city planners find ways to give more and more street space into, you know, outdoor restaurants, into parks, into just places where, you know, families could walk around and have picnics. Giving cities back to the people, I think, would be a wonderful and unexpected development from a pandemic.
Let's welcome a caller now. Rachel from Milwaukee wants to join the conversation. Hey, Rachel.
Hi. So I noticed when you were talking about addressing the bigger picture of pandemics, that you didn't mention the role that animal agriculture plays. And, you know, this is where these pandemics start from. So I think that that's something that we have to address. There's a lot of problems and harm that comes to humans from the way that we treat animals, you know, including antibiotic resistance and things like that.
Yeah, Rachel, thanks for bringing that up. You know, we appreciate it. So, Derek, Rachel's taking us out of the city and, you know, into places where we see widespread, you know, farming, ranching, raising of animals.
Yeah, it's a perfectly good point. I want to do something that journalists maybe don't always do on interviews like this and say, I honestly don't know enough to comment on animal agriculture and its role in this pandemic. Because I'm just not an expert in the intersection of urban planning and animal agriculture, and B, because I actually don't think we know exactly how this pandemic started. I'm not like a conspiracy theorist. I actually am just ambivalent. I don't think we have clear information about literally exactly who patient zero was in the pandemic. And so I don't want to overly predicate or overly, you know, blame any one particular policy for how it started. It started, it's here, it's a reality, we're dealing with it. And I'm focused mostly in my reporting on ways, and this is a local bias or a myopic bias, on ways that American cities can do more to plan against future pandemics and to be safer, healthier places in the future. Yeah,
certainly. Let's bring on Mike from Madison. Hi, Mike.
Good afternoon. Your guest is right on all this. We're so narrow-minded as a country. Prime example, lead in our water supply, Flint, Michigan. They've known it for a long time. They've done nothing. Many other cities have that problem. It's a huge problem that could be easily dealt with, but we refuse to deal with it, much like many things. We're talking about the cities. Great analogy is that, you know, if you climb a mountain and you get a little bit above a mile and a half high, there's no oxygen. So, prime example, if you lock yourself in your garage with a running car, you've got about a half hour, 45 minutes before you die. We have only a mile and a half of breathable oxygen on this entire planet, with a billion cars filling up that equivalent of the garage, which is our contained atmosphere. We know it's bad, but we're unwilling to do anything about it. The best we can do is what we're doing now, is talk about
and
it.
Mike, I want to jump in here because I hear your point, and we only have about a minute left, and I want to make sure that Derek can respond to the idea of climate change as being another crisis that we have to deal with.
Absolutely. It's a huge crisis that we have to deal with. And it's a crisis that I think the most important problem that we have when it comes to climate change actually isn't technology, and it's not science. It's focus. We just don't focus on it nearly enough as a country, really nearly enough even as a planet. I mean, we're talking about a problem that we know is coming, a comet that is moving toward the U.S. at 10 miles an hour that's going to hit us. And we just don't really do that much about it at the federal level. We spend way too little money subsidizing solar and wind and geothermal energy. We spend practically no money subsidizing carbon removal plants, which might be the most important technology on the face of the planet. We just don't focus our attention at the federal level nearly enough on what many of us recognize to be the most important existential problem facing the planet, even beyond pandemics like COVID-19. So,
yeah, Derek, thank you so much for joining us. There's certainly more to talk about in the future. Derek Thompson is a staff writer for The Atlantic, and he joined us to talk about his piece, Get Ready for the Great Urban Comeback. It explores how people responded to catastrophes in the past and how the lessons they learned made modern life better. President-elect Joe Biden proposed the most sweeping plan for combating climate change of any presidential candidate during his campaign. His $2 trillion climate proposal is likely to hinge on bipartisan support from congressional lawmakers. But Biden can use his executive authority to take immediate action in some areas. Danielle Kading reports.
Biden wants the nation's economy to go carbon neutral by 2050 and eliminate emissions in the power sector by 2035. That means that utilities will need to transition away from burning fossil fuels like coal. Dana Kelly says she's been pushing for that after driving out to the South Oak Creek power plant south of Milwaukee.
I made a couple wrong turns when I saw some smokestacks. And that's how I knew I was on the right road, which was actually disheartening to me.
Kelly is an assistant pastor with the Reviving Faith Movement and a community organizer. She's worried about the impact pollution from coal plants has on people living nearby.
Coal is one of those ugly things that is flowing through Milwaukee, and people of color especially are being affected in a negative and at a disproportionate rate.
Kelly says Biden's plans would create clean energy jobs that could be a step in the right direction toward climate and economic equity. She's aware that political division may make it difficult to reach those goals. But the president-elect can issue executive orders to address climate change without Congress. He's pledged to rejoin the Paris Climate Agreement and use the purchasing power of the federal government to drive the clean energy transition. Greg Nemeth is a professor of public affairs at UW-Madison.
And the downside is they're not durable if a new president comes in 4 years or 8 or 12 years and changes direction.
Nemeth says there may be room for common ground as federal lawmakers weigh another stimulus to recover from the coronavirus pandemic.
That might be able to be done in a way so that they can be promoting jobs and employment and stimulating growth and not have it be called climate.
In Wisconsin, Governor Tony Evers set a goal for the state to produce carbon-free electricity by 2050 and created a task force that's set to release recommendations on addressing climate change. Amber Meyer-Smith, Vice President of Programs for Clean Wisconsin, says Biden's leadership can help drive more collaboration.
It can have a big difference in kind of accelerating the pace of where Wisconsin's at.
And in many ways, the market is already accelerating the transition away from fossil fuels in the power sector as coal becomes more expensive to operate. Xcel Energy was the first major utility in the nation to announce plans to go carbon neutral by 2050. Frank Prager is Xcel's Senior Vice President of Strategy and Planning.
The kinds of things that are going to help us enable a affordable and reliable and fully clean energy system. A lot of those things don't exist now. In fact, none of them do. And that's why the value of Congress and the administration focusing on technology advancement is going to be really, really important going forward.
Executive Director Scott Coonan with the Wisconsin Conservative Energy Forum admits he's been arguing against wind and solar for the last decade.
They've come down in cost dramatically in the last decade. Utility scale solar is 100 times cheaper than it was 10 years ago. That puts it at a fundamentally competitive place in the marketplace.
That's one reason why Wisconsin's largest utility company, WEC Energy Group, recently announced it would retire the South Oak Creek coal plant and invest $2 billion in renewable resources in the next 5 years. Standing in the shadow of the plant, Dana Kelly says she's excited to see this transformation.
It'll make us better communities and a better nation overall.
After a bout with COVID-19 this spring, Kelly says she's even more driven to push for cleaner air, especially for communities of color. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is the Ideas Network. Up next, the DNR is looking for volunteers to track wildlife in the state. They'll even throw in the camera. We'll talk about how you can help. That's just ahead. I'm Keely Boltina, and you're listening to Central Time. Thanks for being with us on Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, rural hospitals have faced a number of challenges during the COVID-19 pandemic, from fewer beds to handle the surge of cases to a lack of funding to buy much-needed equipment once the vaccine is readily available. We talked to a rural healthcare leader to learn more. Now, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources is celebrating a milestone for a wildlife monitoring project. It's called Snapshot Wisconsin. Basically, volunteers host trail cameras that take photos of birds and animals. The DNR uses those images to see how those critters are doing. The project began in 2016 in just two counties. Now it covers the entire state and a few days ago collected its 50 millionth photo. And they're looking for more people to help out. Christine Anhalt-Deppes is Snapshot Wisconsin Project Coordinator with the state DNR. Christine, welcome to Central Time.
Happy to be here.
That's a lot of pictures, 50 million. Do we know what that 50 millionth photo was?
We do, but unfortunately, it's not very exciting. The 50 millionth photo was actually of a blank, meaning that it did not have an animal in the photo. And that does happen with trail cameras sometimes. Trail cameras are triggered by a combination of heat and motion, and sometimes warm waving grass can activate the photos. So in this case, the 50 millionth photo was not very exciting, but we have all sorts of more exciting photos that are in that batch of 50 million.
Yeah, and staff members put together some favorite photos from every county in the state. What are some of the creatures we've seen?
That's right. So our visualization that we put together shows a number of different species that we've captured from across the state, ranging everything in everything from squirrels to bobcats to fishers. We've captured some rare species on camera, like marten and a cougar most recently. And we also get some really interesting shots of animals interacting with one another. You sort of get a glimpse into the woods that you might not get otherwise through these trail camera photos.
How many volunteers and cameras do you have around the state?
So as you mentioned, this program began as a pilot in just two counties and launched statewide in 2018. And right now the program has over 1,800 volunteers hosting over 2,100 trail cameras all across the state of Wisconsin.
So help us understand how the project works. What are the details?
Sure. So as you mentioned, Snapshot Wisconsin is this wildlife monitoring program that gives the public an opportunity to get involved in science and generate data that DNR can help make wildlife management decisions with. And volunteers with the program host this network of trail cameras across the state that essentially take snapshots of animals as they pass by. And so for individuals who are interested in hosting one of these trail cameras, they're responsible for deploying a trail camera on land that they own or have access to. This could be public or private land, usually about 10 acres or more in size. Our volunteers are also responsible for then uploading the photos to the DNR several times a year. All equipment and training are provided, so you don't need any prior experience to get involved.
How crucial are citizen scientists to the DNR?
Oh, absolutely crucial. The fact that this is a partnership with the public is very meaningful. As you mentioned, 50 million photos represents an incredible effort, and an achievement of this scale would most definitely not be possible without volunteers. It represents an enormous amount of data that would otherwise not be available for wildlife science and management. And so for me personally, reaching this milestone reminds me of the incredible dedication Wisconsinites have to our natural resources.
And if people are interested in hosting a camera, where do they start? And if we don't have a camera, we can still get access to the data, right?
That's right. So the best way to learn more about the program and how you can get involved is by going to the DNR webpage, and that's dnr.wi.gov, and searching for Snapshot Wisconsin. There you'll find a link to learn more about what it would take to host a trail camera and sign up to do that. But if you're not interested in hosting a trail camera or don't have access to land to do so, we also are in need of volunteers online to identify photos that are captured on these trail cameras. And photo identification, as you can imagine, is the perfect winter activity and a great way to get a glimpse into the wildlife captured across the state from the comfort of your warm and cozy home. And so you can also find a link to that on our DNR webpage.
Excellent. And we've put that up at wpr.org/centraltime too. Christine, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Christine Anhalt-Deppes is the Snapshot Wisconsin Project Coordinator with the State Department of Natural Resources. Snapshot Wisconsin recently surpassed 50 million user photos since it started in 2016. We talked with Christine about how the program works and why it's an important tool to track wildlife. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to a Wisconsin question about a famous building. It comes just as Wisconsin's football season is winding down.
We recently received a question from a listener. John Hansen from Madison wrote to us saying, Camp Randall has more than football history. Could Wisconsin research more of the Native American, Civil War, and namesake history of the stadium? Of course we can, John. Tim Peterson from WPR's Central Time went digging for the answers about Camp Randall's history.
Camp Randall's story begins like many cultural landscape stories. The land where it sits in Madison was occupied by indigenous people, going back about 12,000 years.
And I just want to acknowledge that when Europeans migrated to this area in the early 1800s, the Ho-Chunk people were well established here.
That's Daniel Einstein, University of Wisconsin-Madison Historic and Cultural Resources Manager. Einstein says there are Native American archaeological sites all around the Four Lakes region, though little is known about any activity on the site of Camp Randall specifically. We do know, he said, a bit more about how that land was used around the time of the Civil War.
Before the war and after the war, there were state fairs as well as other major public events like the circus. It was in 1861 that the federal government called upon the states to muster soldiers for the Civil War. And at the time, the governor was Alexander Randall. He identified the former state agriculture society fairgrounds as a place for a military training camp. So Camp Randall is a military training ground, lasted for 4 years from 1861 to the end of the war in 1865. Over 70,000 Wisconsin troops moved through the camp, sometimes as many as 5,000 people at a time. By the end of the war, there were 40 barracks, a hospital, officer quarters, stables, a commissary. One of the stories that is particularly interesting to Camp Randall is the period in 1862 when 1,200 prisoners of war, Confederate soldiers, were brought to Madison and were housed at Camp Randall. During that period of just over a month, 140 of the soldiers died mostly from disease and wounds prior to their capture. And those soldiers were buried in Forest Hill Cemetery, just here on the west side of Madison.
For nearly 30 years after the war ended, the area that had been the military's Camp Randall went back to being used for the state's fairgrounds. Things changed when the state actually purchased the land in 1893.
The property was being considered for residential development. And the veterans approached the state and said, that wouldn't be right to convert these hallowed grounds. So they convinced the state to purchase the property, and it was given to the university for their use, for their exclusive use. And in 1895, the first football game was played on the field next to the agricultural fairgrounds grandstands. And that would have been located where Engineering Hall is right now. So the old grandstand had problems. The bleachers collapsed, and in 1917, the money was allocated to create a new stadium, and the first concrete seating structure was built into the side of Breeze Terrace, that slope on the west side of Camp Randall Stadium. And then subsequently, there were many additions made to the stadium, and now, of course, it can accommodate up to 80,000.
WPR's Tim Peterson brought us that story on the history of Camp Randall. And that story idea came to us from an audience question as part of our Wisconsin project. Submit your own question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up here on Central Time, vaccines to combat the spread of COVID-19 are on the horizon, but rural hospitals may not be able to foot the bill to buy the equipment needed to store them. We learn more about that next here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. Coming up tonight on 1A+, barely half of American adults say they're ready to take a coronavirus vaccine. But work is underway to build trust in future treatments. Hear more about that and the latest news today on 1A+. That starts at 6 o'clock here on the Ideas Network. Now, speaking of vaccines, three major pharmaceutical companies announced in recent weeks that they've developed vaccines that could help stop the spread of this novel coronavirus. While hospitals across the country are preparing for the initial wave of doses, healthcare providers in rural areas face significant challenges when it comes to distributing the vaccines, namely that many rural hospitals don't have the money to buy or lease the ultra-cold freezers that they need to store the vaccines. Our next guest joins us to talk about this issue and other concerns facing rural hospitals in the state, especially as the number of COVID-19 cases climbs. Tim Size is the executive director of the Rural Wisconsin Health Cooperative. Tim, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Kaylee.
Tim, what's your initial reaction to the news that we could have a vaccine soon?
I think like all of us in America, in the world, we're very excited.
And how could that vaccine, once it's available, benefit rural communities?
Well, as most of your listeners know, it's been a tough number of months for both rural communities and urban communities. The summer was not so bad, and then September hit, October, November, and just day after day of increasing cases of people testing positive, and then more and more ending up in the hospital, to the point where a week or two ago, I think most of our hospitals would fairly say they were at capacity. The numbers have dropped a little bit in the last week to 10 days, but most of us are very, very concerned of what might happen once the impact of people getting together for Thanksgiving is almost certain to drive those numbers back up again.
So is this lull maybe a bit of a bright spot when it comes to COVID-19 and the handling in rural areas of Wisconsin?
I'd say very much so. Many of our staff have been working 60, 70 hours a week. This gives hopefully a chance for at least some to get a breather. It also, every minute that we get closer to getting a vaccine and getting people vaccinated is also something we're very thankful for.
But when it comes to that vaccine, I mean, rural hospitals have long been squeezed financially well before the pandemic. And it sounds like the equipment needed to store at least the two American versions of this vaccine, that equipment is highly specialized. It's expensive. So what are we looking at in terms of the challenges of health systems storing the vaccine so they can give it to people?
We're looking at some major challenges. It's the freezers themselves for the Pfizer vaccine are quite expensive. My guess is if that was the only way to go, we would all find money to do it. Whether it's the best use of the money is another question. I'm hopeful that we can use dry ice instead of every rural hospital paying for a freezer they would use for a few weeks and never use again. I think the problem is, though, it's not at all clear how many freezers are actually available. I know some of our members have put an order in for one, but there's no confirmation of when they'll get it delivered. I've heard we could get Pfizer vaccine here in Wisconsin as early as the end of December.
Wow.
I'm not sure if freezers will get here that quickly, but there is a workaround if we have good access to dry ice. I think the bigger challenge in rural Wisconsin, rural America, is Pfizer at this point has said that they will only ship the vaccine in doses of 975. That's a lot more than individual rural hospitals can use in the very initial phase, as there's a priority for the vaccine going to those staff members that have direct contact with patients. So we have either the need for Pfizer to send smaller boxes of the vaccine, or we're going to need, when the vaccine arrives in Wisconsin at various hubs, that those hubs have the capacity and willingness to divide the vaccine into smaller packages. Very complicated logistics.
Yeah, I wonder how you would go about brokering those deals or having those conversations, trying to put the patchwork together.
Well, I think that's the work of our unsung heroes in Madison in state government, who are, I know, working day and night to answer and put together what's a very complicated set of logistics. So basically, there's the federal government has left to the states those decisions. Pfizer and the other companies make their own decisions. So basically how the drugs will be distributed here in the state initially is a state decision. And then eventually it filters down to our rural hospitals, our urban hospitals and clinics, public health, nursing homes, working with their staff to make sure a safe protocol is in place for the vaccinations.
And when you say state decision, are you talking about the Department of Health? Are you talking about the legislature?
I would say it's the Department of Health, but also all the way up to the governor's office. There are also some emergency capabilities that the state has. So there's a few other people involved rather than just the Department of Health Services.
Tim Size is the executive director of the Rural Wisconsin Health Cooperative, and we're talking about rural healthcare, rural hospitals, and the vaccine that could be coming on the horizon when it comes to trying to control the coronavirus and what rural hospitals might need to actually make that a reality across Wisconsin. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Tim, we talked about what happens if you get a major shipment of vaccine and there is a place to store them and trying to figure out that distribution. But what happens if rural hospitals can't afford freezers or if they can't get a hold of freezers? Are we just out of luck?
No, we have the ability. The boxes that Pfizer uses to ship the vaccine will come to Wisconsin. They'll be flown in. They'll be surrounded in dry ice. So what will be needed will be to either for larger hospitals can take the whole box and start to use it. And they have so many days that they can keep it in dry ice, going in and taking out the vials of the medicine and then shutting it back up. For rural, we'll probably need to subdivide some of those boxes into smaller boxes, pack them with dry ice, get them out to the hospital. Then the hospital can keep them in the dry ice as they themselves pull out doses for local use. So there is a workaround so that our rural clinics and hospitals, if they have a freezer, that's great. It'll make it easier, but there is a way with dry ice to make it work. The bigger issue is making sure that the state has the ability with regional hubs to actually break apart the original shipment from Pfizer into smaller shipments. Because if we can't do that, it's going to be really tough getting the medicine out, the vaccine out to our rural communities.
Hospitals throughout the state have changed a lot during this pandemic. What have our health professionals learned throughout the year?
Well, what I've learned, and I've been working in rural health in Wisconsin for almost 45 years, is how proud I am to be part of a fantastic group of people who just are doing great work. I think we've learned that we need, as people in hospitals and clinics, to have closer relationships with our public health departments, both locally and the state. Fortunately, we've only had a pandemic like this every 100 years, but a lot of people feel there are other public health emergencies that we will continue to face. And so I think what we have learned is we need to develop closer working relationships with public health in a way that, frankly, we haven't done in at least my career.
And what do you want listeners hearing this to think about as they go about their lives right now?
Thank you for that question. I think as some friends of mine in our offices at the co-op are in Sauk City, and someone up there coined the term, we need to remember that hospitals are not, and clinics are not the front line. The front line is the community. And we need our front line to do everything they can in terms of masking, social distancing, to keep people out of the hospital. As you know, we've been at capacity. People have been working long hours. We've had to defer certain other needed medical procedures because we haven't had a high enough proportion of our fellow citizens wearing masks, doing social distancing. And so we really desperately need that cooperation. We need the frontline really to be working with us so that we can maintain the hospital for those people most in need and not unnecessarily fill it with preventable cases.
Tim, thank you for taking the time for this conversation.
Thank you. Thanks for covering the issue.
Tim Size is the executive director of the Rural Wisconsin Health Cooperative. He joined us today to talk about challenges facing rural hospitals in the state as the COVID-19 outbreak continues. And that includes a lack of funds, a lack of availability to purchase the ultra-cold freezers needed to store the vaccine, and the way that the vaccine will be shipped in bulk.